You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Human exploration of the moon is once again an American pursuit. Vice President Pence has said he'd like to see Americans on the moon in 5 years. We've been here before, but it's been a while. Just over 50 years since Apollo 8 carried American astronauts out of Earth's orbit and around the moon, giving humanity our first glimpse of our home planet from outer space. Basil Hero is a former investigative reporter with NBC with a lifelong interest in space exploration, and he decided to speak with the Apollo astronauts, now in their 80s and 90s. He didn't just want to recount the astronauts' old lunar missions. He wanted to reflect on what we can learn from their journeys. His new book is The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Basil, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Heather.
24 men went to or orbited the moon, and you call them the Eagles. What was it you wanted to learn from the Eagles?
I wanted to hit on the existential questions. I wanted to examine the anatomy of courage and the true source of courage. And what I discovered from all of them, they kept citing the common good and believing in something greater than oneself. The most interesting quote came from Neil Armstrong about the future of space exploration. And he said that he believed that we had not evolved enough as a species to colonize the rest of the universe. He says, what is it that we're going to be exporting? So there are some really fascinating takes there, with Armstrong, I think, being the most interesting of all. I describe him as a quiet genius.
Each chapter in The Mission of a Lifetime actually starts with bullet-pointed key lessons. What made you decide to frame the story this way?
I thought it would be helpful for readers, particularly younger readers who are unfamiliar with the missions, with the astronauts themselves, and some of their what I consider to be brilliant insights. And also some very key lessons on how to conquer one's fear. These men were not fearless. They knew fear, and the flight surgeons were able to measure it during their mission. So, for example, when Neil Armstrong was attempting the first moon landing, his heart rate shot up to 165. What they had all learned and trained to do was to manage and black box their fear. And it is something that has really been done ever since World War I, when Winston Churchill's Dr. Lord Moran did the first exploration of the anatomy of courage. And what he discovered was what we would call today mindfulness, the ability to focus intently on what's in front of you, and in the case of pilots, their instruments, and to not be sidelined by your imagination, what-if thinking. And the Apollo astronauts were very good at that.
It's interesting, you know, all of the medical attention, psychological training that was going toward the astronauts, the wives got nothing. And yet, at least one astronaut said, you know, the wives had to be at least as brave. They didn't know the mission inside out. They weren't there. There was no, you know, button they could push if something went wrong to try to make things better. It was complete uncertainty, and it really took its toll. A huge divorce rate among these early astronauts, mental breakdowns, at least one suicide. And you talked with some of the wives. Was that something that was originally part of your project, or did that come out of talking with the astronauts?
No, I had suspected that their story was as important to tell as their husbands, because had it not been for them, they could not have accomplished what they did. So they were there completely supportive. And interestingly, the Air Force handbook, the wives' handbook, and it really was a manual that was used in all of the services, quite specifically said to avoid marital squabbles, because it would in effect impact their husband's ability to focus and concentrate while they were flying these aircraft. So,
I mean, they really had to sacrifice themselves for the sake of their husbands, well-being and state of mind during their missions.
That's exactly right. And they, too, believed in the common good and something greater than oneself. And it was, in this case, it was the Cold War mission of beating the Russians. But beyond that, I think there is a grace and a sensibility that they displayed. So I think it's worth reminding people.
Basil Hero, you ended up interviewing almost every living astronaut who went to the moon, as well as their colleagues, their loved ones. You've already mentioned Neil Armstrong as one person who really stood out to you. Were there others, and what made them stand out?
I would say Alan Bean, who was the fourth moonwalker and had become an artist, was also probably the most reflective thinker, along with Armstrong, of the bunch. And he made a very interesting point, and the same thing with Mike Collins, that we are living in the Garden of Eden, and we have just yet to appreciate it, so that when they were out there for 10, 12 days in a vacuum-sealed environment and breathing nothing but pure oxygen, when they returned to Earth, they realized that they were, in fact, in paradise. And Jim Lovell, who was in Apollo 13, made an extraordinary statement. He said, you know, after 50 years looking back, the conclusion I've come to is that you don't go to heaven when you die. You go to heaven when you are born. And I talked to the dean of the Yale Divinity School, Greg Sterling, and I said, have you ever heard this formulation? He says, no, never. It's quite incredible. And interestingly, what has happened in the theology schools, there is a new movement called eco-theology, and it is a direct result of the Apollo missions and the photos that they took of Earth from deep space.
Basil Hero, it's interesting that you mention the fourth moonwalker as one of the most reflective. We often hear so much about the first person to go into space and the first person to set foot on the moon. But sometimes it was those intervening missions or the ones that followed up that ended up being really important. And I'm thinking in particular about Apollo 8, which didn't land on the moon, but was the first time that humans went around the moon. And in addition to getting amazing photographs of the moon to lay the groundwork for landing on the moon, they also got the first photographs and the first real glimpse of the Earth from space. And just as you're saying, this realization of how small, how blue and green, how filled with life our planet is, those pictures of Earth from space, those first pictures of the Earth from space, really launched the environmental movement and apparently really changed some of the astronauts who were on that mission.
It did, absolutely. It was kind of a Galilean moment in reverse. They went to explore the moon and really discovered the Earth. They saw it as the real prize in the sky. And it altered their perception of time, of happiness. Suddenly, you know, they realized that all of the earthly squabbles that we engage in are, in effect, meaningless. That the whole notion, when you're looking at the Earth from 240,000 miles out, you wonder whether it's even inhabited, let alone being able to pick your country on the globe. So the idea of countries, nations, borders, races, just became a ludicrous concept in their minds. It was, we are one. We are one planetary race.
Basil Hero, you've interviewed nearly all of the Apollo astronauts for this book, The Mission of a Lifetime, and this commonality of kind of the spirituality of it, the different view of our planet and the appreciation for our planet really comes through. But there's one astronaut whose views kind of stands out as different, and that's Harrison Schmitt. He is a vocal climate change denier, and as recently as last year said that he saw no evidence that global warming was the result of human activity. How did you navigate? I mean, did that come up in your conversation with him?
Well, I tried. Harrison Schmitt is a really interesting case. He was the only geologist, the only scientist of the 24 who went out there and of the 12 who walked on the moon. He has always maintained that the glacial sort of changes that occur are just part of Earth's geological history. So he's softening a little bit, saying that perhaps man's climate change and pollution has served perhaps as a bit of an accelerator, but that it is not the main cause of climate change. So for me, it was rather frustrating to have that conversation with him. And he really doesn't want to go there because I guess he's getting beaten up by everybody. So I was not able to really do a deep dive into his thinking on this. He almost cuts you off when you want to get to the conversation.
Basil Hero, we so frequently hear from astronauts that since they were a kid, they wanted to go into space. They always wanted to walk on the moon. They always wanted to go to the space station. There's one astronaut who stands out as kind of apathetic about space and says he really just did it to beat the Russians. And after that, you know, he was out. He was actually one of the only ones to quit. What was it like talking with him?
Well, Frank Borman is the one that you're referring to. And Frank really was, you know, he was an exacting West Pointer. And he was deeply, deeply committed to beating the Russians to the moon. The other aggravating factor for him was his wife, Susan, who had a nervous breakdown and essentially said to him, please do not go back out into space. And he had been offered the first moon landing and he turned it down, which is quite something. Borman, however, was profoundly changed by the experience. And even when he addressed Congress, he read from Archibald MacLeish's passage about us being riders on the earth together and that we had to find the capacity to cooperate globally as one, you know, collective civilization. So that was quite a statement coming from Frank Borman, who, you know, was not given to soft-headed thinking. I found him to be one of the more fascinating of the group. It was also touching to see how, for the first time in his life, he really kind of hung his head in resignation, saying that, you know, I've been able to get out of every tough situation. There wasn't anything that I couldn't solve, except for one, which is my wife's Alzheimer's. And it was really the only note of defeat that I think I've ever come across in any interviews with him. So it was quite a touching interview with him.
As we look into the next 5, 10, 15 years of space exploration with NASA's sights set on going back to the moon, but really as a stepping stone to going to Mars, did you speak with these astronauts about our future space exploration and how are they feeling about that?
Well, the majority of them believe that the moon is the best staging area for future exploration of the rest of the solar system. They are less convinced that Mars is the place to go straight away, avoiding the moon, for the simple reason that too many things have yet to be solved. The radiation issue, it's a 9-month trip out there, and the radiation in deep space is far worse than it is in that cislunar corridor between the Earth and the moon. The other thing, of course, is that you have to live subterraneally. And then to be able to resupply a Mars base can only happen every 2 years. So the logistics of it are daunting. The other issue that, frankly, has yet to be fully resolved is whether or not men and women can live in deep space for an extended period of time.
Lots of questions and perhaps a note of caution being sounded by the men who went to the moon. Basil Hero is a former investigative reporter with NBC and author of The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Basil, thanks so much.
And thank you for the opportunity to talk to you, Heather. I appreciate it.
Up next, the neuroscience of addiction, as told by someone who has both studied it and lived it. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.